Work as he believes it would have been performed in Bach's time, with a small orchestra and just a few singers taking all the solo and chorus parts. Live from the Philharmonic Hall in Krakow, Bach's St. Matthew Passion, Sunday afternoon at 5 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
Here on Radio 4 FM now, we continue our Book of the Week. In The World Until Yesterday, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Jared Diamond draws upon his experience of living and working in Papua New Guinea to ask, what can we in the West learn from traditional societies about war and peace? The reader is Crawford Logan.
The Dani are one of New Guinea's most numerous and densest populations, centred on the Grand Valley of the Baliem River. In 1961, an expedition from Harvard University's Peabody Museum arrived to carry out anthropological studies and filming. The campsite selected was in the Dugum Dani neighbourhood, because that area had no government or mission station and relatively little outside contact. It turned out that traditional warfare was still going on. Accounts of fighting there between April and September 1961 have appeared in several forms, especially the doctoral dissertation of social scientist Jan Bruckhauser. Bruckhauser interviewed battle participants who described to him their assessment of each battle, their resulting mood, and specifics of each person's wounds. The Dani War pitted two alliances against each other, each numbering up to 5,000 people. On April the 15th, 1961, a battle challenge was issued and accepted, and about 400 warriors fought until the onset of darkness compelled everyone to go home. About 20 men were wounded on each side. Three had to be carried away, accompanied by derisive laughter and jeers, and shouted remarks such as, "Make those jerks walk themselves, they're not pigs. Go home, your wives will cook potatoes for you." One of those wounded died 6 weeks later. At the time, such actions produced only limited tangible consequences. 5 years later, in June 1966, a large-scale massacre took place. The attack was carefully scheduled for a day when the local missionary and Indonesian police happened to be away. Warriors snuck across a river at dawn under cover of fog to attack. Within an hour, 125 adults and children were dead or dying, and dozens of settlements were burning. Many features of Dani warfare turn out to be shared with wars in many other traditional societies. Those shared features include frequent concealed ambushes and open battles, each with few deaths, punctuated by infrequent massacres that exterminate a whole population or kill a significant fraction of it. Boys are trained already in childhood to fight and to expect to be attacked. It is important to enlist allies, but alliances shift frequently. Revenge plays a dominant role as a motive for cycles of violence. Warfare involves the whole population rather than just a small professional army of adult men. There is intentional killing of civilian women and children as well as of male soldiers. Villages are burned and pillaged. Because warfare is chronic, it has omnipresent consequences for people's behaviour. Finally, absolute death tolls are inevitably low from the small size of the populations involved, compared to the populations of almost all modern nations, but relative death tolls as a proportion of the population involved are high. Among the Dani, all of the fighting between April and early September 1961 resulted in only about 11 deaths. To us survivors of the 20th century and two world wars, such numbers are so low as not even to be worth dignifying with the name of war. But the relative death toll of the Dani War, the number of Dani killed as a proportion of the total population involved, rivaled or eclipsed the casualty rates suffered by the United States, European countries, Japan or China in the world wars. For example, the 11 deaths suffered by the Dani in the 6 months between April and September 1961 represented about 0.14% of the alliance's population, That's higher than the percentage death toll, 0.1%, from the bloodiest battle on the Pacific front during World War II, the three-month struggle for Okinawa, employing bombers and kamikaze planes and artillery and flamethrowers, in which about 264,000 people died out of a total American-Japanese population then of around 250 million. The 125 men, women and children killed within an hour in the Dani massacre of June 1966 represented about 5% of the targeted population. To match that percentage, the Hiroshima atomic bomb would have had to kill 4 million rather than 100,000 Japanese. By world standards, the Dani War was tiny only because the Dani population at risk of being killed was tiny. By the standards of the local population involved, the Dani War was huge. Military historians routinely compile national casualty totals for each modern war. Such rates have also been calculated or estimated in dozens of studies of individual modern traditional societies. The highest percentage long-term death tolls averaged over a century in modern times have been for 20th century Germany and Russia, which reached 0.16% and 0.15% per year, respectively. In other words, 16 or 15 people killed per year per 10,000 members of the population, due to the combined horrors of World Wars I and II. If we compare these war-related death rates for traditional small-scale societies and for modern populous societies with state government, it turns out that the highest values for any modern states are only one-third of the average values for traditional small-scale societies and only one-sixth of Dani values. Average values for modern states are about one-tenth of average traditional values. Trench warfare, machine guns, napalm, atomic bombs, artillery and submarine torpedoes produce time-averaged war-related death tolls much lower than those from spears, arrows and clubs. The reasons become clear when one reflects on the differences between traditional and modern state warfare. State warfare is an intermittent exceptional condition, while tribal warfare is virtually continuous. Traditional but not state wars are periodically punctuated by massacres in which much or all of the population on one side gets surrounded and exterminated, as in the Dani massacre of June 1966. In contrast, victorious states nowadays routinely keep conquered populations alive in order to exploit them rather than exterminating them. A psychological consequence of the increasing range of modern weapons is that most military killing today is by push-button technology, permitting soldiers to kill unseen opponents and not to have to overcome their inhibitions about killing face-to-face. Men in traditional societies grow up from childhood encouraged to kill, or at least knowing how to kill. But most modern state citizens grow up taught constantly that killing is bad until, after age 18, they suddenly enlist or are inducted into the army and given a gun. Not surprisingly, a significant fraction of soldiers in World Wars I and II, some estimates run as high as one-half, could not bring themselves to shoot an enemy whom they saw as another human being. Even when modern soldiers see an enemy face to face, the enemy is almost always a nameless person, someone whom they have never met before. In contrast, in small-scale traditional societies, one recognizes and knows by name not only every member of one's own tribe, but also many or most of the enemy warriors one is trying to kill, because shifting alliances and occasional intermarriages make one's neighbours familiar as individuals. The taunts that Dani warriors shouted at each other in the battles included personal insults. Another big difference between tribal and state warfare involves the differing ease of ending war and maintaining peace. Wars of small-scale societies often involve cycles of revenge killings. A death suffered by side A demands that side A take vengeance by killing someone from side B, whose members now in turn demand vengeance of their own against side A. Those cycles end only when one side has been exterminated or driven out, or else when both sides are exhausted, both have suffered many deaths, and neither side foresees the likelihood of being able to exterminate or drive out the other. While analogous considerations apply to ending state warfare, states go to war with much more limited goals, at most just to conquer all of the enemy's territory. It's much harder for a tribe than for a state to reach a decision to seek an end to fighting and to negotiate a truce with the enemy, because a state has centralized decision-making and negotiators, while a tribe lacks centralized leadership and everyone has his say. It's even harder for a tribe than for a state to maintain peace once a truce has been negotiated. That difference between states and small centralized societies is a major reason why states exist at all. There has been a long-standing debate among political scientists about how states arise and why the governed masses tolerate kings and politicians and their bureaucrats. Full-time political leaders don't grow their own food, but they live off food raised by us peasants. How did our leaders convince or force us to feed them, and why do we let them remain in power? Tribespeople understand better than anyone else the misery associated with warfare, the omnipresent danger, and the pain due to the killings of loved ones. When tribal warfare is finally ended by forceful intervention by colonial governments, tribespeople regularly comment on the resulting improved quality of life. Anthropologist Sterling Robbins was told by Aoyana men in the New Guinea Highlands, "Life was better since the government had come because a man could now eat without looking over his shoulder and could leave his house in the morning to urinate without fear of being attacked. All men admitted that they were afraid when they fought. In fact, they usually looked at me as though I were a mental defective for even asking. Men admitted having nightmares in which they became isolated from others in their group during a fight and could see no way back." That reaction explains the surprising ease with which small numbers of Australian patrol officers and native policemen were able to end tribal warfare in the then territory of Papua New Guinea. They arrived at a warring village, bought a pig, shot the pig to demonstrate the power of firearms, tore down village stockades and confiscated the war shields of all warring groups in order to make it lethally dangerous for anyone to initiate war, and occasionally shot New Guineans who dared to attack them. Of course, New Guineans are pragmatic and could recognise the power of guns. But one might not have predicted how easily they would give up warfare that they had been practising for thousands of years, when achievement in war had been praised from childhood onwards and held up as the measure of a man. The explanation for this surprising outcome is that New Guineans appreciated the benefits of the state-guaranteed peace that they had been unable to achieve for themselves without state government. For instance, in the 1960s, I spent a month in a recently pacified area of the New Guinea Highlands, where 20,000 Highlanders, who until a decade or so previously had been constantly making war against each other, now lived along with one Australian patrol officer and a few New Guinea policemen. Yes, the patrol officer and the policeman had guns and the New Guineans didn't. But if the New Guineans had really wanted to resume fighting each other, it would have been trivially easy for them to kill the patrol officer and his policeman at night or to ambush them by day. They didn't even try to do so. That illustrates how they had come to appreciate the biggest advantage of state government, the bringing of peace.
Crawford Logan was reading The World Until Yesterday by Jared Diamond. The book was abridged by Robin Brooks and produced by Kirstine Cameron.
The Public Philosopher returns to BBC Radio 4.
Given the choice, you yourself would be inclined to choose a boy.
I probably would. I'd worry a lot less. It's very selfish, but yes.
Michael Sandel is in India.
In previous episodes, I've been in the UK and in the US to discuss with audiences some of the big philosophical questions that arise from very concrete and often pressing political issues of the day.
Michael Sandel is the Public Philosopher, next Tuesday morning at 9.